I'm Aaron from Austin.
I'm Ben from Louisiana.
I'm Kara from Burlington, Vermont.
The Sound of Young America is produced independently and supported by listeners like you and me.
If you'd like to support the show like I did,
visit MaximumFun.org and click on Donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne. Live on tape from my house in Los Angeles, it's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on the program is an old friend of our show. He's the editor of BoingBoing.net, one of the world's most popular weblogs. Blogs, I guess we have called them for roughly the last 10 years. He's also the editor of Make Magazine and the author of a brand new book called Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. It's about his embrace of DIY, do-it-yourself culture, despite the fact that he wasn't exactly born into it. Mark, welcome back to The Sound of Young America.
Thanks a lot, Jesse. It's been a while.
So I want to know whether you were handy or good at cooking or grew up on a farm or any of those things before you were, say, you know, 30 years old.
No, I wasn't. When I was in my 20s, I tried to be handy, and I did things like home improvement projects where, you know, we bought a house in Boulder, Colorado, and I thought, oh, I'll put down my own kitchen floor, put down the tiles. So, you know, put down the grout, laid down the tiles, and then for some reason, in a period of like a couple of weeks, about half the tiles just cracked. And I thought, you know, I probably put the grout on wrong or something. So I did that. You know, that was disappointing. And then putting wallpaper on, I could never get it straight and it was crooked. And those kinds of things were just so discouraging to me that I kind of abandoned it. And around that time, that's when desktop publishing started taking off. And that was really appealing to me, design and putting things together. And, you know, you have the undo function, which is fantastic.
Let's talk a little bit about that. Because before Boing Boing was a popular blog, it was a zine in the sort of golden age of zines in the early 1990s. Tell me a little bit about how Boing Boing went from being in print to being online first.
Yeah, you know, it was really a slow process. The zine was a ton of fun. I loved doing that. And the whole zine scene of the late 80s and early 90s was just fantastic. I don't know if you were familiar with a zine called Fact Sheet 5.
This was the zine that was like every zine,
yeah,
right?
The zine of zines. It was kind of like you know, like the Yahoo of zines, just a directory. And so every month I would get it and I would just go through it and with a yellow highlighter, pick all the zines I wanted. I would send Boing Boing. They would send me copies of their zines. I made a lot of friends who are still my friends today back in that era. And then when I started working at Wired magazine, I started working there in like 1993. Somebody said, oh, you should register boingboing.com as a domain. And I thought, oh, that's a good idea. So we did that, and I just threw a few of the old articles from Boing Boing up there, added a little bit of original content, but, you know, really not that many people, maybe 300 people a day visited, and I kind of forgot about it, you know, to the point where when it was time to register the domain again, I just didn't bother to do it, and somebody snagged it, a design company in Washington, D.C. But then I registered boingboing.net.
And this was in an era when, I mean, you're talking about the zine of zines. I remember having a hard copy thing that was called like the Internet Telephone Book or something like that. And looking up, I had a friend named family friend named Ken Mackey, and Ken I knew had an email address, and I remember looking him up in this physical book to find out what his email address was, and his name was in there. It was maybe, I don't know, an inch thick.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. There were, like, at first there really weren't search engines, you know. Nobody was indexing the web, so they had these hard copies. There were this series of books called Net Guides that, you know, Michael Wolff, the Vanity Fair columnist, had published, and they were, you know, in different subjects and stuff. But, it was a completely different era back then. And so Boing Boing just kind of, you know, floated around. I paid very little attention to it. And one reason is because back then it was hard to add content online because of the publishing tools were tough. You know, you'd like write the HTML in a text editor, and then you'd open your FTP program and upload it, and then you would look at the way it turned out, and, you know, there was always a mistake, and you'd have to, you know, edit it and re-upload. And it just was like the inertia of getting something done like that was a hassle. So then I think it was in 1999, I was researching an article about weblogs. At the time, Blogger had started, and I think there were several hundred blogs on the internet, so it was becoming something kind of interesting. So I wrote an article about it, and as you know, part of the research, I registered a Blogger account and played around with it and really liked it a lot. So in 2000 was when I, you know, started actually using Blogger for Boing Boing. And that's when I realized, you know, it was just as easy to write a blog post as it was to write an email and press send. You just write a post and press publish and you were online. I think that's one reason that blogging took off, was just the ease of it. And, you know, standard format of reverse chronological order was something people could grasp very easily. And so that's really, you know, was a big revelation to me, I think, to a lot of other people.
Your story in the book starts with a point of inflection that happened to you immediately after the wonder of this first generation of internet publishing wore off a little bit. In 2003, at the low tide of the internet bubble bursting, tell me about what happened then.
Yeah, well, Carla, my wife and I, we were both freelance journalists. We had contracts with various magazines. Most of them were technology, you know, internet technology magazines. I had a contract with the Industry Standard, with Wired magazine. Carla was a columnist for, I think it was like called Computer Life. And I was writing for Yahoo Internet Life. All these magazines, most of them aren't around anymore. But it was a bad time because the magazines were very thin. It was harder to get work. And it was just kind of a depressing time. You know, people had the wind was knocked out of everybody's sails. And so we were wondering what we wanted to do next with our lives. And so one of the options was that we would try to live somewhere that was less expensive and a simpler life. You know, we were here in L.A. and things were really busy. We had a young kid and another one on the way, and, you know, just driving all around, being stuck on the freeways was not appealing anymore. So we thought about moving somewhere to the South Pacific. And we had been to...
Naturally,
yeah,
of course.
Exactly.
Made the natural leap from Los Angeles to the South Pacific.
Yeah.
God forbid you should move to Portland.
You know, we really were able to slow down and enjoy a lot of things, like preparing our own food. One of the fun things was we had coconuts in our yard, and they would fall out of the trees. And
you would use them to make telephones to call the maintenance.
Exactly. Learning how to open them and use a coconut scraping bench to extract the process. It was like, you know, an all-day process to extract the coconut meat and then convert it into, you know, scones and pancakes. And just doing that and realizing how fun it was to make our own food like that. We started making our own tortillas because you couldn't get them on the island, and our own pasta. And being able to have that time to, like, just really slow down and be kind of a active participant in creating your own food was something that was really a lot of fun. I mean, it probably wasn't something that most people would have to fly 6,000 miles away and sell their house to learn about. But, you know, that's what we ended up doing. But it was worth it. So when we came back to L.A. after 4.5 months on this island, let's keep that idea of, you know, slowing down parts of our lives so that we can, you know, be more mindful and aware and kind of appreciative of the things that we do to keep us alive.
You now had the skills to process coconuts if you had given a coconut bench. I'm sure that you were like me or like Christian the intern over here, I'm presuming, in that you had a limited skill set in terms of what kinds of things you could make and do for yourself. So much of the modern technological lifestyle is about, focusing on one thing that you can be really productive at, earn money, and then trade that money to someone else who has the skill and technology to do something for you really efficiently. So were there things that you knew how to do to slow down, or were you starting from zero?
Yeah, I really did have to start from zero. And I think another thing that kind of pushed me in the direction of doing more DIY stuff was when I started working for Make Magazine, which is, a technology project magazine. I came into contact with, dozens, if not, over 100 DIYers who are like really great, good at doing things, high technology and low technology. And every one of them, told me that they really weren't born handy, that they made a lot of mistakes, and that they were okay with the idea that they were going to make mistakes. And they realized, yes, I'm going to spend money on things that are going to break. I'm going to destroy tools. I'm going to waste money. But I'm going to keep on doing it because I know ultimately, I'll succeed if I keep on trying, and I'll continue to build my skills. And so I thought, all right, I will try to force that mindset on myself and see if it works or not. And so, then I set about in the book, writing down a number of things that I wanted to try, building a chicken coop and raising chickens and becoming a beekeeper and learning how to make my own cigar box guitars, learning electronics enough to do things like retrofit my espresso maker so I could control the temperature more precisely, learning how to whittle so I can make my own kitchen utensils.
I really like the espresso maker control because it's such a wonderful combination of 1925 and 2010.
And that turns out to be like one of the best things that I did. The projects that I picked, I wanted to have ones that had a real impact on my life. A lot of things that DIYers do, they make like robots and cool rockets, or elaborate models of castles and things, which I think is really great, and I'm envious at their skills and stuff. But for me, I need to have the process has to be fun, but the end result has to be something that I can appreciate too. So I always pick things like that. So espresso, I'm kind of an espresso fiend, and I have it, make my own two or three times a day. And I knew I wasn't very good at it. I'd go to Intelligentsia, and it would be far superior than what I could make. So I took lessons from the director of espresso research at Intelligentsia, this great guy named Kyle Glanville, and he gave me lessons. And he told me, that temperature is one of the very most important things that you have to control when you make espresso. And so it turns out that the machine I had, which is a popular machine, the temperature can vary like 40 degrees, water temperature.
Due to some kind of specific issue with the kind of temperature sensor being sort of like a binary on-off type of thermostat.
Exactly. And the analogy is you're driving down the road and you see a stop sign, and it would be like as soon as you get to the stop sign slamming on your brakes, well, of course you're going to, skid through the intersection. And that's so the other approach is, as you see the stop sign, you press on the brake pedal and you just press harder and harder until once you reach it, you stop at the intersection. So I switched the system and put a different kind of temperature sensor and a little miniature controller called a proportional integral derivative temperature control system on there. And so then you can lock the temperature in so it only varies like 1 degree. And so, I have that variable down, locked down. So now I just have to worry about, like the grind and the freshness and other things. But the espresso is consistently better every day. And, it's a big part of my life. And I feel like I've improved that part of it. And, it's just a fun thing. And there are always new things to learn with it. So now I recently took a class learning about steaming milk and doing the art, latte art and stuff like that. So anyway, it's fun.
When you made this list of things that you wanted to do yourself, did you consult with the missus?
Probably not as much as I should have because, it definitely led to some friction, especially the bees. That was a big deal because, my wife has never liked insects of any kind, and bees, are among the worst because they sting. And so, it was like, just getting the bees, She said, okay, well, how many bees are you going to have? Like 50? I don't think you should have more than 50. But, you know, a beehive is like between 100 and 300,000 bees. And so, you know, where were we going to put it? She was afraid they would, you know, bug us in the garden and stuff. And so it caused some definite friction. But in the end, they're far enough away that they don't bother us. No one has been stung except me, and I've only been stung once. And once we started getting honey and extracting the honey, now my wife is like very fond of the bees. It's interesting. You know, once they prove themselves to be useful, it changed. And my attitude changed to the bees too. Now they've become a lot cuter now that we have honey.
Production of The Sound of Young America is underwritten in part by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered online at ask.metafilter.com.
It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is Mark Frauenfelder. He's the founder of the popular blog boingboing.net, and he's also the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine. His new book is called Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. It's about his struggles and triumphs in making things for himself. Let's talk a little bit about a few of these projects specifically. One of the first ones that you write about in the book, and one that I remember you writing a lot about on Boing Boing, is killing your lawn. You live like I do here in Southern California, where we are, you know, in the midst of a desert that is covered superficially in lawns. You know, there are giant lawns in the center of this 6 million population major urban metropolis that's in a continual state of drought. What did you have to do to get rid of your lawn and put something else in its place?
Lawns are just wasteful. You know, I read Michael Pollan's books and, you know, books about how to, you know, turn edible estates, you know, basically how to eat the things that grow so that your plants have a purpose other than decorative.
They're in a way, it's sort of a class statement that comes out of the 19th century, like the landscaping equivalent of binding a woman's feet so that you know she doesn't have to walk.
Mm-hmm.
It's like putting a completely functionless plant on land so that you show that you don't have to work it.
Yes, yeah. I'm so rich that I don't need to use my land to grow food. Yeah, and you know, it's carried over, and people have forgotten the original purpose of it. So anyway, I wanted to kill the lawn and then start using it to grow vegetables and basically an orchard. What I wanted to do was grow fruit trees and stuff like that. In the end, we moved from the house before I was able to do that. But the folks who bought the house from us are actually using it now. I was just over there for the weekend, and they're doing some really cool gardening stuff. They got these big, like, tubes of some kind of rice. Not the actual rice grain, but the part of the plant, and they're in these kind of decomposable tubes. They're like these giant snakes, and you can like roll them up and throw dirt into them, and have like these raised bed gardens. But anyway, they're doing it, and they've also using my chicken coop that I built there for their own chickens. So I'm really glad that they're carrying on what I had started at that house.
When you undertake these huge projects, it seems like a big part of your personal process was learning that it was okay to be bad at them.
Yeah, it was. I figured it was okay to make mistakes on things as long as it wasn't going to, you know, put anybody in physical danger or something. You know, it would all be something that I would learn from, you know, hopefully get better at. And I don't know if it's, I don't mind seeking out the advice of experts, you know, and kind of taking classes and things like that. What I don't like for some reason, and I don't know why, it would be like having someone side by side with me, like doing something. I'd rather take the class and then go home and just try to do it on my own. So that's kind of what I did. And, you know, I'm sure that made it so it was a lot harder. I made more mistakes and it was a lot more difficult to learn something that way. But for me, maybe it's because I'm too embarrassed to like make mistakes in front of other people. That's probably what it is.
There's so often like a really hard line between things that we do to be productive and things that we do to entertain ourselves. So people spend a lot of time working really hard at their jobs. They spend a lot of time working negative hard, you know, watching television or whatever. Was it difficult for you to adjust to spending time doing things that were in between, things that were productive, that had, say, food at the end of them, but weren't a more efficient way to get food?
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think, like, you know, carving wooden spoons is a good example of that. You know, you can go to IKEA and get a carved, you know, spoon, wooden spoon for 99 cents.
You have a tremendous passion conveyed in this book for the carving of wooden spoons.
There's something wonderful about it. I compare it to, I imagine it's a lot like knitting. You know, I learned how to knit, but it didn't really stick with me. It was not as fun for me as carving spoons, but it kind of put me, you know, I could see the relationship. It's, you know, it's meditative, you know, it slows you down. You have to watch what you're doing, but you can still have a conversation with people. A lot of times what I would do if I had a conference call for like Make Magazine or something, I would just put on my headphones and have the call, and just sit out on the back and just work on the spoon. And it's a lot of fun, you know. If you look at it in one way, it's a really inefficient way to spend your time, because if it takes me 3 hours to carve a spoon that costs, you know, 99 cents, that's like 30 cents an hour for my time if I wanted to sell the spoon. But it's great. And again, you know, the end result is something that I can use. And it's fun, you know, to stir up my pancake batter or soup using a spoon that I made myself. It sounds ridiculous, but if you do that, it's something that you appreciate every time you have it, you know, and the more you can do like that in your life, I think the more of a sense of control you have over your environment is a good thing.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for taking this time to be on The Sound of Young America. It was great to have you.
Thanks a lot, Jesse. It's fun.
Mark Frauenfelder is the editor of Make Magazine, founder of Boing Boing at boingboing.net, and the author of the new book, Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne, America's radio sweetheart. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our music provided to us by Dan Wally. The show edited by Nick White. Our associate producer is Julia Smith. And our intern is Christian Natividad. You can find us online at MaximumFun.org, where you can download any of our past programs, absolutely 100% for free, or share something that you've heard today with a friend. We'll see you next week right here on The Sound of Young America.